here. So I just want to explain one thing about postmodern, in case somebody doesn't know what that is. Postmodern basically gives you license to say whatever you want. Postmodern is a term that lets you say whatever you want and then to claim that it's not just modern, but it's postmodern. I'm not even being cynical right now, but maybe a little bit. Maybe a little bit. But there is such a thing as a feminist and post-feminism, and I'm going to get a little bit to that as we don't like introductions, we just want to try to learn.
So is this a postmodern
shiur? Depends how late it goes. The Book of Esther is so rich, and the amount of sources that I sent you, 6 pages, so like there's no way in the world we're going to get through them, and I even brought more over here. So there's just simply no way that we're getting through everything, so just apologize for that as well. So let's begin. So what's the Book of Esther about? That's a rhetorical question. Is it a happy story? Is it a sad story? Is it a comedy? Is it a... I don't know, what would you call it? Is it a...
History.
Who's the hero? Who's the hero of the story? Who's the main character in the story? No, the main character of the story is certainly Ahasuerus. The main character in the story is certainly Ahasuerus. And he is the center that everything else revolves around. It could be that when you're Jewish, what do you tend to do? You try to look for the Jewish angle on things, so we somehow turn this into a Jewish story, right? Right. So I'm not going to give you a harder time on that, but I do think that the most interesting relationship in the story is between two people who, as far as we know, never meet. Yes, and who are those two people? No, they meet. They meet. They meet. The most interesting relationship is the one of the two people who never meet. And so should we try again? And who would those two people be? Vashti and Esther. That's the most interesting relationship in the story. Vashti, certainly. Certainly, Vashti and Esther is the most interesting relationship. And it's the one which, if I'm not mistaken, we don't give a second to think about, because why should we think about Vashti and Esther? Because what in the world do Vashti and Esther have to do with one another? Unless, of course, the answer is that they have everything to do with one another. So let's pause there again, and let's start at the beginning, maybe even before the beginning. Our main characters, and here when I say main, I'm not using Academy Award definitions. I'm using definitions and terms in the book. So Ahasuerus is a main character. Vashti, you can claim, is really not, because she's only there in the very beginning and then sort of steps off the stage. But I'm going to consider her a character, because I already said that that's an important relationship. Esther, we named the book after her, so you want to keep Esther as an important character. So we have three so far. And who are the other two? The other two are Haman, who is a pretty important character in the book, and finally Mordechai. So let's start again now. And what I'm going to do is I'm really going to base myself on two separate things. One is information which we have in the Gemara, which, by the way, sometimes is contradictory, and it's not as if there's just one approach that it takes. And the other is based upon our reading that we're going to have in the text. Some things in terms of one basic approach I did hear from Rabbi Soloveitchik, but there's going to be a lot of other things that we're going to put in as well. So let's start in the beginning in terms of the first and the main character, and that is somebody in the very beginning who's the very first source, Vayihibi Me Ahasuerus. The whole story, the background, it happens in the time of Ahasuerus. Hu Ahasuerus Hamolech Mehodu Bad Kush Shevav Esrim Me'a Medina. Now, the first thing is that as Jews reading this book about Ahasuerus, the first thing that strikes us and that should strike us is the use of the term in the very second verse, and then it will come up again and again, and that term is Shushan Habira, Shushan the capital. So for Jews, when we talk about the capital, what is the capital? Or shall we say, what is the permanent and historical and the non-negotiable, never-to-be-divided capital, and so on. So the capital is Yerushalayim. Does Yerushalayim ever make a place, is it ever mentioned in the book? Yes. Just because I ask questions that you think it's no, it doesn't mean it's no, it's yes. It is mentioned in the book. But we'll hold off on that. But as a Jew reading Shushan the capital, Shushan the capital, Shushan the capital, and it comes again and again, and incidentally Shushan and Shushan the capital may not be the same place. You have Washington DC and then you have Capitol Hill, right? It's not exactly the same. One is a really bad neighborhood and the other is a worse neighborhood. So right away we're introduced to Shushan HaBira. Shushan HaBira, and as Jews we should be saying, hold it a second. And that takes us out of the text. And it takes us to other places in Tanakh, which we're not looking at. It takes us to this realization of exactly when and where does this story take place. Well, where we're just told, but when is it taking place? What else is happening in other places of the world at this point? Why are the Jews in Shushan HaBira right now? Why are we going to find ourselves caught up into what essentially should have been palace intrigue, which takes place all the time, probably as often as you have a palace, you're going to have palace intrigue. The only thing which is intriguing about this palace intrigue is that somehow we got caught up in this palace intrigue, which then leads us to the second question, so what are we doing here? So the answer to what we're doing here goes back to this other part of the story, which is not told here at all. The other part of the story is, well, the Jews went into exile. Okay, we know that. That's a theme which has probably been, not probably, which has been the majority of our history has been one which takes place in exile. Okay, so we went off into exile, and we went off for, and that's the question, well, how long were we supposed to be in exile? And the argument could be 70 years. And one of the comments, which is the background to the beginning of the story, is that it was known to Ahasuerus as well that the Jews were only going to be there for 70 years, and they're still here. And I want to stop here a second. Most likely the story takes place after we have started to build the second Beit HaMikdash. And that is something which is actually such a strong point and such a painful point, which he was going to ask the question again and say, why in the world were they there? And you know what the answer is? I don't have a good answer. It's like sort of American Jews complaining they have no one to vote for this year. So, guess what? Who cares? You're in the wrong place. You're in the wrong elections. It's not where you're supposed to be. This story as well, they're not supposed to be there. And the Jews already have started to build the second Commonwealth, but then it got paused. And why did it get paused? Well, one of the reasons is not enough Jews are there. Now, when we go back and read this as the backdrop to the story, that in the other part of the world, you have a couple of crazy Zionists who started to build the second Beit HaMikdash, but the practical people, the pragmatic people, they have aligned themselves with the major superpower, because that is, right, and life has never been as good, and Jews have never had so many rights, and we're even invited to the parties, and look how good it is to be over here, and look how nice we... Should I stop already, or should we get back... And this is the greatest thing that ever happened to us. And a matter of fact, and let's continue reading again. So he's sitting on his throne. Keep that in mind. I actually spent this morning creating a timeline of the whole book. Okay, so that could be very important. Bishnat shalosh lemolcho asam mishte lekol sarav vavadav chel parasu madai hapartimim v'sarim dinot lefanav. Barato et osher kivod malchuto v'et yikar teferet gdulato. Again, anybody with a little sensitivity to Tanakh knows that those words have been used before. Those words, teferet, yikar, and so on, Those words have been used to describe the Kohen Gadol, or Kohuna generally, the clothing of the Kohen. This is why Chazal come and say that one of the things that he was doing is that he walked in wearing the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. Now, where do they get that from? What are they talking about? Well, that's this realization that the other side of the world, where the Beit HaMikdash was being built, it stopped. It stopped. Not only that, when the spoils were carried away, so where did they end up? So I have a secret for you. They didn't end up in the Vatican. Nebuchadnezzar carries things away, and let's pause right there again. He makes this whole party. 180 days. He makes a 6-month long party. He's been king for 3 years, and he makes a party for half a year. I'm saying that should show you a little perspective over here. It took, right, 3 years to settle, and he makes a party that goes on for half a year. And now again, the people in the capital. He makes for them, Lim Gadol Va'ad Katan. What does that tell you? That he is very fair. And who does he invite? Who is included? Everybody. Included in the everybody is who? The Jews. Everyone's there. He's an equal opportunity partier. When he parties, Mishteh shivat yamim bechatzar ginat hamelach. He makes another party. Chur kapas utchelet achuz bechaleibut va'argaman uglidei kesel mideshesh and so on and so forth. Right, hashvashkot bekeleza bekelim mekelim shonim, which we read in the tune of Eicha, because the whole reference over here is to things having to do with the Beit HaMikdash. So there's actually what's stated and what's not stated. What's stated is Shushan Habira. What's underneath the surface over here is Yerushalayim Habira. What's stated over here is all of the glory and all of the honor and all of the wonder of what he has in his coffers. And he shows this off to everybody, which now this is the new wonder of the world, and this is the new, this is the man who is incredibly powerful. Although he does have a little bit of a problem, because even though he rule everything, rov kiyad hamelech vashtia kedat ein ones. How do you translate ein ones? Well, when it comes to wine, he doesn't rape anybody. But when it comes to other things, then perhaps it does. The shtia is kedat ve'ein ones. Kichen yasad ha-melech, which means the melech is fair, he's equitable, and so on. Gam vashti al-malka asta mishten nashim, beit ha-machut shel melech Achashverosh, and she also made a party for the women. So now, I just want to pause over here for a second, because everything sounds very nice. We have a very nice king, we have a very fair king. We just don't know one thing, and that is how he became king. That's an important issue, so let's leave off that for a second. We also have a queen, and our queen is having her own party, and she's drinking with the women, which means that they were quite, had the sensibility of tzniut back in old Persia. The men drink separately, the women drink separately. Of course, that's not necessarily the case. We'll just look at source number two. The Gemara tells Barotot Osher Kavod Malchotov Yekar Tefertum Yosi Rabbi Chanina Melamid Shelavash Bigdei Kahuna. There you have the Gemara black and white. We see that he wore the clothing of the Kohen, and that's why it says Yekar Tefertum Bilatov Bahatim Ktiv Lachvod Ula Tefaret. Whereas I said the same words are being used. Source four, we'll skip three for the moment. After 7 days, and this is in Shushan Bira, this is the capital, these are different people. Different people live on Capitol Hill. Different people live in Shushan Bira than are outside. And when it comes to them, what does he do after 7 days? By the way, the man did hold his drink for 180 days. He said a politician, 180 days for the general party, there was one thing. But now when it came to the 7 day party, something else happens. Amar Lemahuman, which obviously may or may not be someone who we will later on get to meet, he says in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Laviyat Vashti Hamalka, Lefne Hamelech, Beketer Malchut, Laharot Ha'amim Vasarim Et Yafya Kitovat Marehi. He wants to show off to the peoples. Now, these are the peoples who lives over here in Capitol Hill. So this is going to be the people who are the wealthy, the people who are the aristocrats, maybe some of the diplomats, and certainly the ministers. And to them, he's going to show off the queen. Now, that's a little strange, because why show off the beauty of the queen to these people, all the people, certainly the people of power? So now we need to back up a little bit to read a line, or maybe two, in the Gemara. And then with that, we're going to start our new introduction to the story. In source number three lines from the bottom, it says, Tachad Vashti Harisha'a, Vashti the Wicked. Now, what did Vashti ever do to be called the Wicked? When we read the text of the Megillah itself, there's absolutely nothing that she ever did that deserves to be called wicked. Tachad Vashti Harisha'a, Bat Bino Shel Nevuchad Netzer HaRasha, Shesaraf Refidat Beit Hashem. Which means the Gemara's understanding of why Vashti would be called wicked, because she comes from the royal family. She is the one who came from the family who destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. As I said, the Beit HaMikdash is the background of the story, and she's the one who, where this wickedness came from, where the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Who is Achashverosh? Turn to source number six, which is actually on the same page of the Gemara. V'yitzov ha-melech ma'od. Amai dalka be'kulei hai. Why did he get so upset? What set him off? Dalka. What lit him up? What set him off so much? Amarava, because she sent him a message. Sholchalo le. She sent him the following message. Ahurayare da'aba. stable boy of my father. Abba, lekabel alfa chamra shati v'lo rave. My father can drink thousands of bottles, and this didn't happen to him. Haigavra eshte le michamra miyad b'chamato barabo. Translate. She says, I'll tell you the word she says, then I'll tell you what she really means. She says, you drink a little bit, and you get yourself drunk and are acting like a fool. And my father was able to drink, and he was able to hold his drink. But what she just now did is one of the most important points in terms of the background to the story. She just now made a comparison. I told you I'm interested in the comparison really between Vashti and Esther, but Vashti just now made a comparison between her father and between Ahasuerus, and there's a reason for this. First of all, she hurls an insult at him, and that insult, by the way, will be found later on in the text, but she hurls an insult at him. The insult that she says is, you are just my father's stable boy. That's all that you are. So now let's go to the first scene, which is not in the Midrash, it's not in the Megillah, and we're making it up. If any of you want to write it down, you can claim authorship on it. Here's the first scene. And, you know, if we make a movie, this is the way that it's going to start. Many years ago, and here it is, you have a boy, teenager, and he's working in the stable. What do you do when you work in a stable? And if you ever work in a stable? Okay. So he's shoveling the things that you shovel when you work in a stable. And what kind of air is there? Well, not the cleanest air. And you have basically very dusty and very moldy and very smelly. And then there's a ray of light that comes through the window, a ray of sunlight. And he goes and he looks out the window, and there in the background, what does he see? He sees the palace. He looks at the palace, and it's breathtaking. And then on the second floor in the palace, a door opens up, and a young, beautiful girl walks off onto the balcony and starts to comb her hair. And he looks at her, and he says, someday she'll be mine. And of course, the reader or the watcher is not sure who we're talking about. If it's the palace will be his, or the girl will be his, or everything will be his. And at that moment, Ahasuerus decided that he was going to marry Vashti. But there's a very, very big difference between the two of them. And that's what this Gemara just now told us. He's a stable boy. And what does she say to him? What's she really saying to him? You can take off your stable boy's clothing and you can try to wash that smell off of you. And you can even put on the royal clothing, but you're still a stable boy. That's what the Gemara just said, drove him completely, completely crazy. That was what he could not take. Because as much as, and you can look this up if this really interests you, that there's literature which is mainly late 20th century, early 21st century, that will say that the real hero of the book of Esther is Vashti, because Vashti is the only real feminist over here. And she's the one who basically tells a man to drop dead and go to hell, so therefore she is the hero of the story. Although, it doesn't necessarily work out all that well for her, which is why we're going to really a post-feminist or a post-modern read of the story, which may be more significant. Although I will tell you a secret. Vashti is never killed in the book of Esther. Right? It never exactly used the words that she was killed. Rather, what does it say? Yitet. Ima lamelech tov yitzei devar malchut milafanav yikatev betatei paras madai v'lo ya'avor eshalo tavo vashti lefnei hamelech achashverosu malchuta yitein hamelech l'ru'uta hotova mimena. The kingship will be given, or the queenship will be given to somebody who took her place. Never says that she was killed. This is one of the wonderful things that we have in our imagination. I'll tell you another secret. It never says in the Megillah either that she had a tail. But everyone knows that she had a tail. But everyone knows that she had a tail. I'll tell you another secret. The easiest costume is to dress up as Vashti. Okay. What? Horns. Okay. The Gemara also says. So let's go back again. And now the second scene that never happened, that's never recorded, but this one definitely happened. As I'm claiming the first one happened, the second scene is skipping a little bit, and Vashti, by the way, did you notice anything about her name? It also comes about drinking. Vashti, Mishte, drinking. There's drinking there as well, and we need to explain her drinking. See, the reason why you can think that there's a feminist side of the story is because what do they say? Well, Vashti wouldn't come, and all the other women are not going to listen to their husbands as well. And then they have to pass the law that the women respect their husbands. That's my favorite part of the Megillah. So again, the next... So let's skip a scene now, and then I'll tell you the next scene. What happens in the next scene that we're not going to describe completely is that there is a coup. And Ahasuerus leads the coup, kills the whole old regime. Him and his soldiers take over. So what do they do when they take over? They take over the palace. And what else do they take over? They take over the queen, they take over the wives, they take over the daughters, which means the problem that his advisors complain to him, if Vashti opens up her mouth to you, all of our wives who are part of the old regime are all going to be complaining and not listening to us as well. Which means the next scene in the story, which is, again, I'm saying, I never saw this, but this is my imagination. They're sitting at dinner together. How long is the table? Okay, very long. Where are the two of them sitting? Ahasuerus is at one and she's at the other. It's set up with the most beautiful cutlery, most beautiful napkins and plates and everything imagined. She has in her hands, and she's like touching the food, but she obviously has no appetite. He's sitting there with a whole, you know, leg of... in his hands and you know, the food is dripping down his, and she just is looking at this and saying, look at this, a pig eating another pig, or something to this effect. And he says, what did you say? And she says, nothing, absolutely nothing. And that's the next scene, because the next scene, as I said, I'm making all this up, but why is this so important? Because now you really understand the relationship over here. What was she for him?
Compass.
A trophy wife. Right? In the most literal sense, she is his trophy wife. Which means he basically has captured everything that he has wanted. He's captured the palace and he captured, I don't know if she was the princess or the queen. I don't know how old she is. I don't know how old she is. Although I do know one thing about her. She drinks. And who does she drink with? The other women. Who are the other women that she's drinking with? A bunch of women who are basically people who are drinking out of desperation, out of sadness, out of depression. Right, but they're all drinking together. These are people who have no respect, no love to their husbands. And that's why the advisors over here get so worked up. And they turn to Ahasuerus, and Ahasuerus can be manipulated. And this leads us to another point. In source number 5, there's a machloket Rav and Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel. Chad amar melech pikeach haya, v'chad amar melech tipesh haya. One says he was smart and one said he was dumb. So this was the point that I'll quote from Rabbi Soloveitchik. He said that he was troubled by this. Generally you have an argument that somebody is smart or very smart or dumb or very dumb. It's very unusual to have an argument, is he smart or is he dumb? So he suggested as follows. He said that Ahasuerus had a personality flaw, which by the way may have been developed, maybe because of the lifestyle that he had. And he was paranoid. The reason he was paranoid was because that's the curse that he endures for having captured the kingdom by force. Which means now, when he's looking around all the time, he's looking at the next stable boy, the next chef, the next waiter, the next everybody. He's looking all over the place. Who is the next person who did essentially what he did when he was young, who's plotting and planning to take over for him? So because he's paranoid, so that's the argument. Is he fundamentally smart, but because he's paranoid, does he end up really doing dumb things because he can be manipulated? Or is he essentially dumb, but because he's paranoid, he's so sensitive that he ends up making some smart decisions? So that's how he understood this argument of the Gemara. So, and I want to go back, because he is manipulated at this point. They turn to him and say, you better make a choice right now. Your princess, your queen, is making a fool out of you, and because of this you're going to end up losing the entire kingdom. So make a choice. Do you want to keep the queen or do you want to keep the kingdom? That's essentially what they're saying to him, because you will have, and here is the most frightening word that he can, well, actually there's a couple words. One is assassination. He does not like that. By the way, according to secular sources, if we know exactly who this is, which is very difficult to ascertain, then it's possible that he was killed in approximately the 30th year or so of his kingdom. He was assassinated at the end. But as I said, making these identifications is actually quite difficult. And if he actually lasted on for 30 years, that's not so bad. According to, again, if the identification is correct, he became king at 36 and he made it to 66, which is not bad at all. But at the end, he actually was assassinated. But he's afraid of assassination. He's afraid of rebellion. He's afraid of losing the kingdom. And any kind of word of rebellion that gets him. And you'll notice that all the way through the story. That's all you have to say to him to get his attention. You know, these people, you can't trust these people. There may be rebellion. That's it. Over here, the women are all going to rebel. That's all you need. You have to stop her. And he's put in a ridiculous situation. Choose between your queen or your kingdom. And of course, it's obvious which choice he's going to say. He's not going to be a romantic and say, you know what? Who cares about the kingdom? I just want to spend more time with my queen. I mean, that's, you know, I'm willing to abdicate, and we'll spend our time together living in poverty because I love this woman so much. There's no love over here. There may be lust, there may be other things. So let's stop, because this relationship that I just now described is absolutely essential to understand everything which happens afterwards. So essentially, and by the way, if I ruin the whole story for you, then essentially the story is a story where a man, a king, is convinced to kill his queen because of his top advisor, and then a man who subsequently is convinced to kill his top advisor by his queen. Okay, that's the whole story. But there is a couple of details that I may have skipped. So let's look at the other details then. So Vashti, we understand. How much time goes by? Now you will know this. Now I'll be very disappointed if you don't know. How much time then goes by between the removal of Vashti and the appearance of Esther? 4 years. Until Esther takes the place, four years go by. So therefore, he's without a queen for these 4 years. But on the other hand, think of the bright side. There's a beauty contest. Although, let's be honest, it's not really a beauty contest. You know, I don't know if you know this, but beauty contests are quite sexist. Yes? Yes. But this is not a beauty contest. I don't know of any delicate way to put this, which is age appropriate for the people in this room. No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all, not at all. The vast majority of the women who are there, as far as we can tell, they absolutely want to be in this. The contest is the contest to become the new queen. Most women, as far as we can tell, all the women here, with the exception of one, all the women want to be here. All the women, they ask for the perfume and they ask for the makeup. And actually, it's a little scary to me. A Persian woman with 6 months of makeup on and is a scary thought to me. But they prepare. They want to be there. If you lose the contest, you enter into the king's harem. You are in his harem for the rest of your life, which means entering this contest means entering the king's harem. And I'll say it again. As far as we can tell from the people's behavior, except for Esther, who behaves differently, everyone else seems to be far more enthusiastic about this. Again, you're thinking about this as a modern woman. You have to think about this as a postmodern woman. I'm kidding, but you know, you have to go back to a couple thousand years ago. For the average person who lives, this is a wonderful opportunity. I get to join the king's harem. So I'll say this again. As far as we can tell, from you can call it what you want. I'm not going to debate. But it seems to me that for most women who are living in this life, to now enter into the king's harem basically means they're in the harem, right? This is great. They live there. Their food are taken care of. It's even better than a husband. It's better than a husband. It's better than a husband because there's lots of other women to bother with him, and he only calls you every now and again. No, stop it. See, that's your mistake. That's your mistake. So I'll say it again. If you think about life, what it was like 2,500 years in Persia, you essentially had somebody who basically had to work very hard just to survive. I'm saying survive, to have a place to live, have food to eat, put on the table, and you join the harem, so that's it. Everything is taken care of, you know. But yeah, you have to work a little bit every now and again. You have to work nights every now and again. But just, no, you're in the harem. Right, but I'm going to say it again. They don't go home after this, which is great. Anyway, we're obviously not going to agree on this point. This was their meal ticket, and this was their meal ticket, and you're forgetting one point. This is their lottery ticket, which is a win-win for them. Either they're part of the harem, they're taken care of for the rest of their lives, and there's a chance they become queen. For them, this is the most wonderful opportunity that happened. A matter of fact, so you see, that's why you're completely misunderstanding the story. Very important you came today. And this is actually why Esther wins. So I have to hold off for a second. All the other women were enthusiastic participants. All the other women would do anything they could to win because they wanted to be queen. Which leads us to Esther and why Esther is somebody who has been attacked by 20th century feminists. Because Esther is passive. She's docile. She's taken. She's taken from her home. She's taken here. Things are done to her. She can't even say who she is. She listens to Mordechai. She listens to Achashverosh. She doesn't do anything herself. Esther has complete passivity to the point she won't even ask for makeup. She won't even ask for perfume. And why is this? Very simply, because she doesn't really want to win, because she doesn't really want to be there. Now, here is the great irony of the story, which you can't possibly understand unless you got that point A of all the other women wanting to win, and Esther being completely standoffish. A matter of fact, I'll even put it this way, that Esther played hard to get. So why did Esther play hard to get? Because she was hard to get. That this was like a major revelation. But why? Because Esther comes across as standoffish, as aristocratic, as not really wanting anything to do with Achashverosh, and all the other women are throwing themselves at him, which means, what does Achashverosh say to himself? All these other women will be great for the harem, because that's what they act like. But she reminds me of somebody. She reminds me of Vashti. Because Vashti also treated me like this. I'm just trying to point that the reason that I know that the firm way of saying this, and I apologize, is that because that there was this magic dust put on her, and therefore she found favor. No, but it's not just that. It's that Esther's attitude towards Achashverosh was absolutely more aristocratic, more regal. It wasn't cheap like the other women were, because all the other women wanted to win. So the irony of the whole story over here is that Esther's not wanting to win the contest is exactly the reason that she went to the contest, because Esther, more than all the other women, remind him of Vashti, who was this prize, this crown, this woman. Can we be honest? Before this contest as well, Achashverosh did not spend many evenings by himself. Okay? It wasn't that he wasn't on J-Date. It wasn't that he had a hard time finding companionship. That wasn't the issue over here. It was finding a queen which was the problem. And losing the queen was something which was traumatic. Because why? Because we all know the first scene of Megillat Esther, which is unwritten, and that's him seeing her all those years before, and now he had to let go of her, and that was something which is very painful, but now he has a queen again. And that is the important part over here. Okay, so far who do we have? So far we understand Achashverosh is paranoid, and by the way, as they say, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that no one is out to get you. In fact, they are out to get him. So that's good. We have Esther, who is very interesting, but as I said, the comparison with Vashti is important. By the way, it's so important that I also have to ask myself another question. If Vashti keeps her dignity by saying, I will not be humiliated. Yes? I will not be humiliated. I will not allow you to drag me across and show me off as a conquest. So you have to ask yourself the same question. So why doesn't Esther do the same thing? Why doesn't Esther say, I absolutely refuse to participate in this. I refuse to be used like this. I have my dignity, and if you have to kill me, then kill me. I mean, like, okay, so I'll die, okay, Kiddush Hashem. Who cares? And now you realize that painful line that she goes because Mordechai told her she has to go. Which means, like, what's going on over here? I'm going to say it again. The key relationship in understanding the entire book is this relationship between Vashti and Esther. And the fact that Esther goes is something which goes against everything in terms of our intuition. And not only that, when you make this comparison between Esther and Vashti, there are some places that we see some similarity, but there's also places that we look up to Vashti and say, okay, now why can't Esther channel her inner Vashti? And the point is because she was told not to, and therefore we have this passive Esther that we still have a question mark about. So let's continue. Along the way, now we have to introduce the favorite character from the story, and that is Haman. So how are we going to describe Haman? So I'm going to say a couple things which are obvious. I'm going to say a couple things which aren't obvious. And obviously, I'm going to have to try to prove all of these things. One is that he was somewhat of a megalomaniac. Now, that itself is interesting, how you could be a megalomaniac, because what would be the indication of this is that he makes everyone bow down to him. The second interesting relationship is the relationship between Haman and Achashverosh. Because Achashverosh is paranoid. How does he possibly deal with a guy like Haman who's making everybody bow down to him? Achashverosh was so sensitive to his being king. How does he let a guy like Haman do this unless somehow he believes that all the honor they give to Haman is all the more so is given to him? But that this is not a very simple thing for us to understand. I mean, again, Achashverosh is so paranoid, you can't come and see him unless you've been invited. He's so paranoid that if he sends out a rule, it can't be changed. You can just do a new rule, but you can't pull back, withdraw an old rule. We'll get to some more things about his paranoia, but Haman is a megalomaniac. Yes, he's somebody who has this insane need for power. He's also somewhat of a narcissist, which perhaps goes together. He's also bipolar. So that now I caught your attention. He's also bipolar. That also I have no question about as well. Now the reason that Achashverosh likes him so much is that he never sees him on his lows. He only sees him on his highs. And the difference between a Haman and a normal person is his highs are very high, his lows are very low. But he normally sees him on his highs, and when he's high, he's manic. When he's manic, he just gets so much more accomplished than a normal person possibly can. And that's what Achashverosh loves about him. Because having Haman over there, who's doing everything and taking care of everything, what's Haman able to do? To do the things that he loves best. Count his money and drink. Which means he doesn't need to do anything else, because he basically can trust him. And he trusts him to the point that he actually gives him his ring, and okay, you're my CEO, you run the company over here, and I'll count the dividends. So we have an interesting relationship, but again, my point is that Haman is a megalomaniac who is a narcissist who is bipolar. Which one have I not convinced you of so far? Okay, I will. Let's continue then. So now we have this little point about Mordechai. And Mordechai refuses to bow down. I mean, can you imagine the op-ed in Haaretz the next day? These religious Jews, you know, putting the whole people in danger, which by the way, Chazal asked, you know, how does he have the right to put the entire people in danger? Everybody bows down to the lunatic. I'll add one more thing about him. He's also an anti-Semite. Okay? And Achashverosh knows it. Okay, so let's now go on a little bit. So, Haman is slighted, and as narcissists can be, especially megalomaniacal narcissists can be, when they get slighted, especially when they're bipolar and it causes total depression, so you have to deal with the depression, and you know what works even better than Xanax or some other kinds of things? Go kill a bunch of Jews. You don't know how much that can cheer you up. He probably even got a prescription from his psychiatrist, and he said, well, this is a way that I can feel much better, so why get rid of one Jew? We can get rid of all the Jews, and this will be very healthy therapeutically for him. So now, this is essentially what happens. Let's kill all the Jews. So Mordechai shows up with sackcloth. Esther, who is very sensitive, who knows the king is very sensitive, says, what are you doing? Coming to Shushan Habira, dressed this way, could be perceived as some kind of a rebellion. It could be perceived that you're rebelling against the king. And that's the correct read on this. Is because people think that you don't like the king. You're protesting the king. You're protesting the government. And this is something which is terrible. She sends him clothing. He refuses. Now, by the way, notice right there, this is not the same Esther. She just told Mordechai what to do. Shift has already taken place. Of course, you can talk about character development and others. The other thing is, how many years have now gone by? How long has she been, if you already have your charts now? How long has she been queen? She's been queen probably on 4 or 5 years at this point. We don't know how old she was when she became queen. You want to say 16 years old? You want to say she's 20, 21 now? The age there could be enough of a difference between somebody who's very, very passive versus somebody who becomes a bit of a stronger personality. So I'm saying it could be age, could be character, could be a response to the times, but either way, Esther has now told Mordechai what to do. Mordechai says, you better do something. God's good, right? Doesn't use the word God. Salvation will come somehow, right? And we notice how hard he works not to say God, right? Salvation will come somehow, and that sets Esther into her plan. Now, her plan herself is very, very simple. It's very simple, and you know, within all plans, we have both strategy and tactics. What is the strategy and what is the tactic? The strategy is that she has two males who are her problem. One has been her long-term problem, Achashverosh, and the other one is Haman. And what she needs to try to do is to work one against the other. That's essentially what the strategy is. The tactic, as we'll see, will be a little bit even more interesting. But what she's going to try to do, she reads the fatal flaws of each of them, and she's going to work one against the other. So what she does is, and now right here, it's dangerous. She's going to walk into the palace, but she says, I have not been called there for 30 days. She's been queen for 4 or 5 years, but even she can't walk in whenever she wants to. Walking in uninvited could be a death penalty. Here's a man who sees plots and plans all over the place. He trusts no one. And Esther, till this point of the relationship, has been very Vashti-like in terms of her distance. She wears the royal clothes very nicely. She looks very good, but very aristocratic. And she has always been very, very distant to him emotionally, which, of course, what does he want, as most men, what he can't have. And therefore, it makes her more attractive to him. And she's the one conquest that he really is having the most difficulty with. Of all of his conquests, he's having a very hard time with her, and she walks in uninvited. Now, for Achashverosh, in his mind, two things happen. One thing that happens is, this will cause him right away to get defensive and to be scared, because that's his personality. The second thing that happens is, this time before she goes in, she puts on a little makeup, and she puts on a little perfume, and she puts, what's the, that sparkle stuff, and I don't know, you have to, what else they put on? She puts on everything, and she walks in, and he sees her. And he says something which he obviously doesn't mean, but it shows you how desperate he is. Up to half of the kingdom I'll give you. And our response to that is, yeah, right. And what does she do for the first time? What does she do? She smiles. By the way, men are very easy. I'm just going to tell you now. She smiles, and she laughs at his humor. And she says, I haven't seen you in a while. Why don't you come by tonight? Now, again, I have to pause right there. What's going on in his head? Again, he has to be careful, but on the other hand, what's he thinking? Oh, she finally came around. She finally realized what a man I am. She wants me. Which means he's got his paranoia, but he's got his ego, and both of them are right there at play. And then she drops the hammer on him, and she says, and bring Haman with you. Now, that's devastating. That's absolutely devastating. Because at that point, Achashverosh's mind starts to spin. And he's basically, what in the world is going on over here? And at this point, he knows deep inside, there's a plot. There is a plot. He just doesn't know who's the plot. Is it Haman? I mean, who do I have to kill now? Do I have to kill Haman? Do I have to kill Esther? Are the two of them in this together? Something is going on, which means she just now pushed his button, and that is that paranoia. And he's going out of his mind. Now, Haman, on the other hand, gets the invitation. If Haman were smart, now I can't use the word smart, if Haman were not Haman, if Haman had just read The Prince by Machiavelli, he would be far more careful in this. He would be saying to himself, the king and the queen and me. Now, how does Haman read this? The king and the queen and me. Yeah, that makes perfect sense, right? Why? Because he's a megalomaniac and he's a man's a lunatic. So he thinks, of course I should be there on this private party. But someone else would say, the king and the queen, something's going on over here, and I better find out what this is, and I better plant in the king's head an idea that I should be someplace else tonight and not be there. I'm saying, that's what somebody who was really a good advisor of the king would have done till he figured out what was going on over here. But Haman couldn't do this, because Haman, as far as he's concerned, is great. When we get to the party that night, you have three people. What's Esther feeling? She basically has one bullet in her gun, and she has to use it right. Achashverosh is going out of his mind because there's something going on. And Haman, he's flying high as a kite. Let's party. This is great. At this point, Haman is completely manic. Which means, what did Esther just do to Haman? She just took him as high up as he can possibly go. I'm in the party, the king and the queen and me. This is great. His narcissism and his megalomania has been fed. So here you have him at the top. And what happens when he walks out of the party? He sees Mordechai. And what happens? He crashes. And what does he say when he comes home? Everything I have is worthless. He has money, he has power, he was even invited with the king and the queen, but everything I have is worthless. What just now happened? What happened to him? The answer is Esther happened to him. Esther just now created a situation that he went so high, and because he was so high, he came down so low. Now, one of the things that's going to happen now is now that he's so low, he's going to get careless. So what advice does he receive? The advice is, okay, so go get rid of Mordechai. Kill him now. By the way, there's actually a death contract out in all the Jews. If he can wait a little bit, if he can actually wait 11 months, every Jew in the world's going to be dead. He could have laughed at Mordechai and said, Mordechai, you're going to be dead, your mother's going to be dead, your father. Everyone you know is going to be dead soon. Start digging a mass grave. It's over. You're all dead. But he can't do that. Right now, he crashed, so he's going to put up the gallows. Now, that is a little politically dangerous, because Mordechai was somebody who has, in the past, helped the king. And he knows that, which is why he has to ask the king for permission. Why have to ask the king for permission to kill Mordechai? He's in charge of the whole place, because Mordechai is somebody who has a connection with the king, and he needs to be careful. So now, if I pause there again, I don't know if you noticed the language. They say to him, put up the gallows. Yeah, it's in source 14. V'yetzi haman v'yom hu sameach v'tov lev. Only person in the Tanakh is described that way, happy and full of good cheer. But when he sees Mordechai, he gets filled with anger. Controls himself, because obviously he can't do something to Mordechai immediately. It has to be a law for him to do it. And he says, for Ohavav, and for Zerach Ishto, and he says, Kvod Oshro, V'rov Banav, V'kol Shegidlu Amelech, and all the power that he has, Pasuk Yud Bet, and he says, not only that, Esther the queen, she invited me to the party, and tomorrow also go to the party. V'kol Zer, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Einenu Shoveh Li B'chol Eta Shenir Ed, Mordechai Yudi Yoshev B'Shar Melech. Everything I have is worthless. But Tom is Erish Ishtova, Cholavav, Yasu Eitz Gavoa, Chamishim Ama, Uva Voker. By the way, notice what they say to him? And in the morning, go over to the king, right? Kill Mordechai, and then you can go to the party happy again. They know he needs his therapy. What therapy does our narcissistic anti-Semite need? He needs to kill a Jew, and then he can be happy again. This is his therapy. This is going to make him happy. But you notice at home to go in the morning, and what does he do instead? He goes in the middle of the night. Because as soon as he starts on this plan, he gets manic again. And when he gets manic, he can't control himself. The king, on the other hand, the king is freaking out, totally going out of his mind. Why? Because something's going on. How do I know that he's paranoid now? He can't sleep. So what is he doing? Let's read through the records. Is something happening? He finds that Mordechai has taken care of him, has helped him. What did I ever do for him? Did I build up that relationship? You haven't. Okay, at that point, I think there's fear in his voice. Mi b'chatzer, Haman, bring him in. How does he feel towards Haman at this point? He's testing him. And he says, so what do you think that a king should do to honor somebody who he wants to honor? And Haman says the worst thing to a paranoid king, but it's obviously this is what a narcissist megalomaniac has to say. Well, give him the king's clothing. Put on the king's crown. Put him on the king's horse. Now, it's very interesting when then Achash says, okay, do all these things to Mordechai. What does he call him? HaYehudi. Mordechai the Jew. He knows that Haman's an anti-Semite. He's heard the jokes that he's told. And he tells him, can you do all this for Mordechai the Jew, and you lead the horse? What did he just now turn Haman into? A stable boy. Which means he essentially has taken Haman back to where he has begun, and there's a very clear warning over here. You know, just as you've come up, you can very easily go down. And at that point, by the way, Haman now has gone complete now into depression again. And when he gets into depression, he gets very careless. So we go to the party the second night. The second night, Achashverosh is just as, even more so, than the night before. Esther, as I said, is not all that happy either, but she basically has one chance. Haman now is completely down. Right? He was manic the night before. He's completely, completely depressed now when he comes to this party, which means he's not himself. He lost his groove. He's there, but he's not there. So he's much weaker. And at this point, Esther decides, this is what she's been waiting for, and now she strikes. And she says to the, and the king again says, half of my kingdom, which again we know is not true. What is it? And well, there's somebody who wants to hurt the king. Okay? Is that the best way to get his intention? Obviously. She gets his attention. The best way? Someone wants to hurt. And not only that, wants to kill the queen. Hold it. I'm going to lose my queen again? Meaning, again, that's not something that he wants. If you were willing to kill the king, but somebody else could have, even when they're suspicious, just kill Esther, kill Haman, why take a chance? Again, just realize somebody else would have acted that way. A stronger personality would have acted that way. But he does not want to do this. He doesn't want to lose the queen. He doesn't want to lose Haman, even though he has reasons not to trust either one of them at this point. He has suspicions. And she now is pointing the fingers at Haman. And at that point, something terrible happens. They've all been drinking. Haman's depressed. She's scared. Ahasuerus is paranoid. And what does he do? He walks outside to clear his head. At that point, she thinks she lost. Because the logical thing to do at this point, the whole thing was set up for one result. And what was that result? Kill him. What are you waiting for, you idiot? Kill him. Self-preservation. This man is trying to do these things. And now of all times, Ahasuerus has to clear his head and let me think clearly and walks outside to get a breath of fresh air. So I'm saying, just realize now where Esther's at. Because she's not convinced that she won. Because if she won, he never should have walked outside. He should have taken him out to be killed at that point. And then we read, to my mind, one of the most astounding commentaries. 16 says, "V'hamelech shav meginat abitan." He comes back inside. "Hamelech el beit mishtei ayayin." "V'haman nofel al mitasha Esther aleh." And he falls down onto the bed that Esther was lying on. "V'yomer melech hagam lichbosh." By the way, that word is a very strong word. What does that word mean? A conqueror. So what's in his head? His head is not, it's not adultery. What's in his head? A conquest. It's a rebellion. Look at 17. This I found in the Torah Shlema. Rav Kasher has a Megillat Shlema as well, a volume on Megillat Esther. Rav Brachi b'shein Rav Chia Avui, Esther balat gvura hayit. She was exceedingly strong. By the way, if you want, you could take it literally strong in terms of her personal strength, in terms of emotionally, strong religiously. But what did she do? He pila oto aleha. She grabbed Haman and she dragged him down on top of her. Umra neheraga nibahu b'tenetzel uma. She said, okay, so we'll both die together now, and at least maybe I'll save the people. Do you realize what this is saying? That her mindset is as follows. The whole first part, she slept with this Ahasuerus for all these years. You want to use the word rape, I'm fine with it. She was taken against her will and so on. She's passive all the way through. At some point, essentially last night, things changed. And she had to now be friendly and nice and reach out to Ahasuerus. And now it didn't work. So now she says, okay, I slept with one pig, I'll sleep with another pig. And she's trying to seduce Haman right now. She pulls Haman on top of her, hoping that they'll get caught and Ahasuerus will kill the two of them. Because she's basically saying to myself, this idiot can't even understand. He's supposed to kill Haman at this point. It's not working. So she goes to plan two and she pulls him on top. Fortunately for her, Ahasuerus walks in right then and says, are you trying to rape her? But it's not rape that he says. That doesn't bother him. Rape doesn't bother Ahasuerus. What does bother him? That word that he used. Conquest. He sees a conquest taking place. Are you trying to take over my kingdom? Esther is very lucky at that point that she survives this. But I'm just saying, 5 minutes ago, we were not convinced that's the way it's going to end. So I'm going to say it again. So what was Esther's plan? Esther's plan was use the personality of Ahasuerus and his weakness and his paranoia, get it going even more, use the megalomania, the narcissism, and are you convinced with the bipolar party or not of Haman, and use that against him and just put the two of them against one another and hope that they're going to crash? When it doesn't happen immediately, she's willing to go the next step now. So I want to go one level deeper, and so far everything I told you is pshat. So yes, everything I said so far was pshat. So now you know what pshat is. Pshat is what the person who says it convinces himself is pshat. That is the best definition of pshat I've ever seen. Okay. So everything I've said till now is what I've convinced myself is pshat. But I want to go now a little bit deeper, because in Chazal there's a couple of more things. There's a Gemara in Chulin, source number 20, which asks about four people, which makes no sense whatsoever. It says, Moshe min HaTorah minayin. How do we ever know there will be a man like Moshe? And quotes a pasuk in Bereishit, Bishagam hu basar. Haman min HaTorah minayin. How do we ever know there will be a man like Haman? It says, Hamin ha'etz. Esther min HaTorah minayin, Banoch estir astir. Mordechai min HaTorah minayin, Dichtiv mar duror, Umetagimin and Mered Dichia. This Gemara is impossible to understand. What exactly is the common denominator over here? So I'm going to tell you what I think it is. I've seen hints from other places, but everyone was missing one little piece. So I'll explain to you what the missing piece is. There's a halacha, which is written down, it's brought down in Shulchan Aruch. You're not allowed to say the name of something which is considered Avodah Zarah. All four of these names are connected to Avodah Zarah. So which one is easiest? The easiest one is Mordechai, which is connected to Marduk. You don't even realize how funny that pasuk is when it says, Ishi Hudiya Yabushushan Bira Ushma Mordechai bin Yair bin Kish. Mordechai is the name, Marduk is the name of a god within Persia. That's hilarious. Esther is suspiciously close to something called Ishtar. Ishtar is something like Venus, it's a sex goddess and so on. That is very funny. By the way, the Gemara knows it. The Gemara knows this and says that Esther is Eilat HaShachar. Mizmor Eilat HaShachar, which is the morning star, that talks about Esther. The Gemara knows that Ishtar. So therefore, you have Mordechai and Esther, who are Marduk and Ishtar. Does Haman try to make himself into some kind of Avodah Zarah by making anybody bow down to him? And the only one that didn't make sense to anybody is Moshe. What's Moshe doing here? Well, who named Moshe? And I think we learned about this a couple months ago. Who named Moshe? Bat Paro. What did she say when she named him? Who claimed he was the god of the Nile? Paro. What did he name his daughter? Bithya. What did she claim about Moshe? That the Nile gave birth to him. Which means the Gemara over here is asking, how do I know I'm allowed to say the names Moshe, Haman, Mordechai, and Esther? Now Moshe, of course you can say, because how many times does it say Moshe in the Torah? Answer, a lot. But the Gemara is trying to say, what's the pasuk? What's kibad shagam hu basar? Rashi points out, bishagam hu basar, bishagam is begematria. Rashi tells us, look at 21, bishagam begematria kamo Moshe. And what's the rest of the pasuk say? He's going to live for 120 years. This is a verse after God has his disappointment in men. Man is flesh and blood and lives 120 years. Moshe is flesh and blood, will live 120 years, but he's not a god. Which means that's what the Gemara understands. As I said, that's already comes out of Rashi. The others, a person like Haman, where does he come from? Hamin ha'etz. So which tree are we talking about? So this is the Eitz HaDaat Tovara. So who does Haman then remind us of? Haman reminds us suspiciously to the Nachash, Garden of Eden. And that's his Gemara. The other two characters, of course, Mordechai and Esther, we still need to understand. Esther is Astir, Astir Panai. She's hidden. The whole purpose of the story here is to reveal what's hidden, Megillat Esther, to reveal what's hidden. And Mordechai is Maradachia, which actually sounds almost like how you say Mordechai in Galiciana, I guess. To say Maradachia is Mordechai, Mordechai. But it itself is a little funny. Mordechai is this pasuk. The pasuk about Mordechai, it says, is more dror, is b'samim, more, by the way, in Gematria is also Amalek, more is 240, dror is freedom from Amalek. Sender, try to convince somebody of that in Purim, it's easy. Tov. On Purim, everything's easy. You can ask, if somebody from Amalek converts, does he have to kill himself? No? Okay, anyway, let's continue. I said yesterday in Shul, I said that there's a halacha that Esav sameth Yaakov. But it says that when Esav comes and he sees Yaakov, he hugs and he kisses him. So what's the? He was such a rusher, he even went against that halacha. Okay. So let's come back now to this Gemara, because I think that there's something which will emerge from this which is incredibly important. Haman is connected to the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge, good and evil. By the way, the theme over here of eating what you shouldn't be eating from then goes down to the Jews who participated in this meal. They never should have participated in the Suda. They never should have been celebrating over there. They never should have been using these kelim. And therefore, this first sin goes and floats over to this later sin. Second point. The B'nai Yisachar tells us that when the sin of the Garden of Eden, every single sense was corrupted, except for one. It says that listens to the words of the Nachash. Sorry, Chava, listens to the words of the Nachash. She sees the tree, touches the tree, eats from the tree, and the only sense which was not corrupted was a sense of smell. She never smelled from the fruit. The way that sin gets healed is through the sense of smell. When the Jews, again, by the foot of Har Sinai, worship a golden calf and do all the terrible things that they do, later on Yom Kippur is going to come, and Yom Kippur is going to heal for the sin of the golden calf, which itself, I'm saying again, is very similar to the sin that took place by participating in the Seudah. What will be the Avodah that the Kohen Gadol does when he walks inside Lefnai v'Lefnim? He uses the Ketoret, which means he uses the sense of smell. Mordechai, therefore, who is the Mordor, Mordechai, therefore, who represents the Ketoret, he represents the antidote, as it were, to Esther. So, but I need to say another thing about Mordechai, because we barely gave Mordechai any attention whatsoever. Who is Mordechai, and how is he described? It says, Ish Yehudi, Haya B'Shushan Abira, Source 7, Ushma Mordechai Ben Yair Ben Shimi Ben Kish, Ish Yimini. He's described both as being Ish Yehudi and Ish Yemini. The Gemara in source number 8, which I will just tell you what it says, has no idea what to do with this. Is he really from Yehuda, but he lived in Binyamin? Is he really from Binyamin, but he lived in Yehuda? Was his father from Yehuda and mother from Binyamin, mother from Binyamin, father from Yehuda, or any other combination that you want? They don't know what to do with this. Make up your mind. Ish Yehudi. Now for us it's easy. Ish Yehudi means a Jewish guy. It didn't mean it earlier. Ish Yehudi generally means somebody from Yehuda, so what is he? So again, I want you to think a little bit deeper. What is it that is represented by the crossing of Yehuda and Binyamin? And the answer is the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash is in the portion of Yehuda, and the Kodesh HaKdoshim is in the portion of Binyamin. Ish Yehudi, there's one person who represents the one sense that was never corrupted. He's the one who won't bow down. He is from Binyamin. We're told that all the other sons of Yaakov bow down to Esav. The one son who won't is Binyamin, because he wasn't born yet, but he doesn't bow down. So therefore, Mordechai lo yichrav, lo yishtachaveh. In the future, he will never bow down, because he's from Binyamin, but he represents this mix of Yehuda and Binyamin. He is the Beit HaMikdash. He is the Kodesh HaKdoshim. He represents the Ketoret. He represents the Ovodah of Yom HaKippurim, which means the whole background of the story was the Beit HaMikdash, and was the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, and was this whole corruption of not having the Beit HaMikdash. But there's still this one funny thing. There is this, and there's one more thing I need to tell you about the Ketoret. The Gemara asks about the Ketoret, how exactly does the Ketoret work? Look at source number 31, and this goes down to how you make perfume. Amr v'chanur babizna, amr v'shun chasida, kol ta'anit she'in ba poshei Yisrael, einu ta'anit. That when we turn to God, we need sinners also. It's not good when only tzaddikim pray. We need sinners to pray as well. And what's the proof we need some sinners? Sherei chilbana, which is one of the ingredients of the Ketoret, rechora, it had a terrible smell. Umana hakatuv ben samanei haketoret. Nonetheless, it was used as part of the Ketoret, which means how do you make the Ketoret, which represents the part that was never sinned? You take sin and you cover up the sin with a good smell. You take bad smell, cover it with a good smell. How does tshuva work? You take something which is bad and you cover it with something good, and then you bring it into the Kodesh HaKodashim, and somehow that works. Which leads me to my last source for today. All of us have heard at some point somebody say, and with a great deal of confidence and able to convince us that this makes sense on many levels, that somehow Purim and Yom Kippurim are connected. Correct? I've seen dozens of commentaries. Most of them never tell you where it's from, and none of them that I've ever seen have quoted it inside the context where it comes from. So we'll look at the context. Source number 32. V'ihi Yom HaKippurim. And this is Yom Kippurim. What happens in Yom Kippurim? V'kad ishkatatet kadmei belavushin shapirin. He dresses himself in beautiful clothing. The inan levushe kapara. What makes the clothing beautiful? Because it's clothing of atonement. It's kreitzitz dilei, matznefet dilei, avne dilei. It's all of these various things that the Kohen Gadol would put on. This includes the four white clothing, as it were, that the Kohen would wear. Misitra d'yumina, from the right side. Umi'arba bigdei smola, misitra d'smola. Bigdei zav, misitra d'smola. And the things which have gold on it, from the left side. But who's Zimna? When he puts on that clothing, the itkashet to be ilan, levushin de kapara, when he puts on the clothing of kapara, itmabe, it applies to him the verse, what verse of all verses to quote? The tilbash Esther Malchut. And Esther put on the royal clothing. Ubahuna at lefnei velefnim, and then when he goes to the inner sanctum, he goes inside to the Kodesh Hakodashim, haduchtiv, and then it says, betamud b'chatzer beit hamelech hapnimit. He goes into the inner sanctum to see the king. Uvahona sachin be'inav, and if he finds favor in God's eyes, v'raza demila v'ra'it l'skor brit olam b'yad Hashem shema Hashem slacha Hashem akshiva v'asei al ta'acher, Purim itkara'et al shem yom ha-kippurim. Purim is called because of Yom Kippur. Now those of us who have no idea what he just now said, what the Zohar said is as follows. When the Kohen Gadol goes into the inner sanctum, goes l'fnai v'l'fnim, again, if the Kohen Gadol makes one mistake, he can die. Just like if Esther makes one mistake, she can be killed. If the Kohen Gadol, when he goes in, he puts on special clothing, just like Esther. What the Zohar is saying over here, when the Kohen Gadol goes in, that he tries to be the model, the role model for the Kohen Gadol to go in and to bring forgiveness for the people is Esther. Which means, and it's suggesting that when Esther went in to see the king, now all of us can say, hold it a second, she put on the makeup and she smiled and she laughed at his jokes and she basically had to seduce him that day. What it's saying, yeah, that's all very interesting, but that's not where her neshama was. Her neshama, when she goes in, is like the neshama of the Kohen Gadol who's going in on Yom Kippur to save the people. That's where Esther was at, and that's the level that the Kohen Gadol tries to get to. When he puts on his clothing, he's like Esther putting on royal clothing. And when he goes in, he's like Esther going inside. Which means, forget about feminists and so on. This statement of the Zohar is the strongest statement. He said, who was Esther? Esther was the Kohen Gadol. Who is Esther? She goes in and brings kapara for the entire Jewish people. Who's Esther? She's the one who defies a plan and saves the entire people. Where was Haneshama when she went in? Well, you got the hint all the way through the story. How do you get the hint? It's the Kelim Shonim, and the Yakar and Teferet, and the whole background was the Beit HaMikdash. And who is Esther? She's not who you think she is. Because she's actually Mordechai's cousin. By the way, not niece. She's actually Mordechai's cousin. And who is she? I'll tell you a secret. She's also from Yehuda and from Benjamin. She also represents the Ketoret. And what's her real name? Hadassah. Hadassah has a beautiful smell. Which means, who is she? She's the Ketoret. She's the one who goes about and brings about kapara for the whole Jewish people. And that's the inner story of Megillat Esther, as far as the Zohar is concerned.